Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. There are plenty of moments when politicians make us groan, and occasionally they make us proud. But when is the last time a presidential candidate made you laugh out loud? My guest today has been laughing at politicians, or at least with them, throughout his long career in journalism. Charles Osgood is the anchor of CBS News Sunday Morning. His new book is called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the White House: Humor, Blunders, and Other Oddities from the Presidential Campaign Trail. Charles, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, we all say stupid things all the time, or at least I do.
Me too.
And thankfully, there's not a camera crew or a journalist waiting to pounce on that and spread it to the world. Do you ever have any empathy for politicians who say incredibly dumb things?
Absolutely. And I think there's been a change in that. When politicians would say something stupid or say something other than he really meant, in the past, it didn't matter. People would laugh or they would groan or whatever, but then that would be the end of it. But today, there's somebody out there with a camera. It's going to be on YouTube within hours. And I think the whole process now is that each side is waiting for the other to commit some gaffe so that you can say, gotcha, now this is the sort of a person this really is, because it's in those things you say in unguarded moments. So everybody is so careful these days. You just know, and I think that the people who are handling the candidates are telling them, you have to just be really, really careful. And so they are, but I think we pay a price for that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There are several places in the book where politicians reveal the fact that they can't wait till they're done campaigning, win or lose, because they can let their guard down.
I think that's true, and we've seen it happen. I mean, a notable example was Bob Dole, who was always thought to be a very funny sort of a guy and very likable. And everybody knows that likability, I mean, just personal charisma, if you want to call it that, is a very important factor in an election campaign. You don't want to vote for somebody you don't like. And we tend not to like people who are cranky and giving us a hard time and giving everybody a hard time. So when Bob Dole was running, he made a studied effort to be a serious person, more presidential. And I think he paid a terrible price for it. And
he came across as irascible more than anything.
Yes, I think so. And when he did say something that was supposed to be funny, it had a little bite to it. These were not victimless, unbarbed jokes. There was somebody on the other end. And I think that's really what it's become. But when the campaign was over, you know, when we knew him as the guy who was talking about Viagra on television, and he did that with a little twinkle in his eye, and he smiled the way he knew how to smile, but was taught not to do it when he was trying to run for president. I think that's it. That's a shame.
Yeah, another example of that would seem to be Al Gore, who people will tell you that behind closed doors, in private, he's a funny guy, and boy, that certainly never came across.
No, the opening of that film of his, where he said, my name is Al Gore, I used to be the next president of the United States. It's just a wonderful little mind warp there in that sentence. And I don't know whether he wrote it or somebody wrote it for him, but it works. And I think everybody's jokes are funnier if they're not something that, you know, that was written by a gag writer, but that they thought of at the moment. In other words, this is not something you're just not hearing lips move and the vocal cords activated. It's actually passing through their mind. There is a thought process. Think is a very dangerous word, of course.
We're learning that. You know, it is funny about those moments that are spontaneous, because I think about Hillary Clinton had a great line about, you know, I should get more credit because it takes me so much longer than the guys to get ready every morning. Yeah. The first time I heard that, I thought, what a charming thing to say. But apparently she says it now every place she goes.
It's just one of those lines. She had one recently under tremendous pressure to end this long national nightmare of a campaign, and she said she had gotten a message from somebody. I don't know whether she really had the message or not, but it was a good line. She said, the message said, it's not over till the lady in the pantsuit says it's over.
How much of what candidates say do you think is pre-screened these days, and has that changed in the past 30 or 40 years?
Oh, I think just about everything is pre-screened these days. because, you know, one little slip, and it's all over the place. And I think it gets in the way of friendly discourse. You know, political discourse ought to be, well, the way I see the problem is this, and be given a chance to say the reasons for it. Not necessarily to demonize the other candidate, but that's what it's become. It is now conventional wisdom that people don't vote for anybody, that they're voting against somebody. So you have to give them something. You have to give them some reasons for the person to vote against.
Well, and the irony is, with all that control, we in the media have to seize on those rare moments where we get a glimpse behind the curtain.
That's true, and also because, you know, this is the search for a soundbite, something that you can say. Newt Gingrich is terrific at this. I mean, he was able to put together two sentences that took 7 seconds altogether that made the point that he wanted to make. But that's not necessarily the best formula for thought.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, has there ever been an American Churchill?
Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln was so quotable, and he wrote his own stuff. You know, there weren't any writers. He didn't wait for the writers to hand him his Gettysburg Address. That's what one of my favorite misplaced modifiers is, that Abraham Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address while riding to Gettysburg on the back of an envelope. So what your mind sees is the president sitting on an envelope.
Quite a way to travel.
But he tried to use those cadences. I think that he had picked up from the King James Bible, and to use that in his, and that's why there's so much wonderfully quotable things. The stuff around the Lincoln Memorial in Washington that's chiseled into those words sound as if they were written to be chiseled into marble.
How much power do you think the comedians have now in the political process itself?
Well, you got to show up on the Tonight Show. You got to show up on Letterman, and on Laugh-In.
But that
was Richard Nixon's. You know, famously, during it was a political campaign, and both he and Hubert Humphrey were asked to appear on Laugh-In, and he did. You know, talk it to me.
I guess cool to see him out there, and yet he didn't really fit. What was the reaction at the time? It's hard for me to imagine a time when Richard Nixon was popular enough to be elected president.
But he was elected president twice. Mm-hmm. He also was defeated once. But he won that election.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was after Watergate. I mean, after Watergate had actually happened, it hadn't really brewed to the point where it was a scandal, but it was something, you know, to so that when he said "sock it to me," later on when you look at that, you say, "Well, I guess they did." but also, I think having to appear on these shows, those lines are too good. You can recognize a line that's been written by a writer, and some deliver them better than others. I thought Mike Huckabee was very entertaining in the primary, and I think it's probably one of the reasons he got as far as he did. And the press treated him kindly because it was fun to hear that stuff.
One of the things that distinguishes your show from virtually anything else of its kind on television is that there is not just a tolerance, but a reverence for silence. And it occurs to me that that's something that you have when you're writing for television, that despite all the other disadvantages, you really don't have when you're just writing for print.
Well, I think there's a difference between print and broadcast, but there's also a big difference between radio and television in that regard. And I think silence, it can even be funny. You know, the famous Jack Benny business about, you know, your money or your life. And there's this pause. And then he says, I'm thinking. You know, that's a classic line, but he used the silence. Paul Harvey, for all of these years, there's a big pause between the Paul Harvey. Good day.
You never quite know if he's coming back.
That's right. But we always refer to this as dead air. Yeah. And in radio, dead air is like, oh, wait a minute. It's like having no picture in television. So there's that difference. But I really do think that the language is important in both. You have to learn the differences. If you write to put a picture in somebody's mind, and you're on radio, that's terrific because that's the, I think radio is more visual than television in that regard, because you know there's the so-called theater of the mind. Every listener will hear it in a different way. On television, if you put a picture in somebody's mind and it's different from the picture that's on the screen, there's a dissonance there, and it means that it doesn't work. What you have to say is something that will make them look at that picture in a different way.
When you're writing, is the sound of your own voice in your head?
Certainly not the sound of it, but I've been doing this now. I've been at CBS for 40 years. Yeah. So I know what's going to be comfortable to me to say. And I don't write all my own scripts because you can't. If you're doing an hour and a half show and it's a news show, somebody is going to have to have written some of it. And I the first thing that I do when I come in on Sunday morning is to look at the prepared script. And it's not to look for mistakes, because there are hardly ever any mistakes, but just whether this is something that's been put the way I would put it would come naturally to me.
So people wouldn't imagine this, but basically your easiest days are the weekends, even though many people associate you more than anything else with the television show.
Well, that's true, but I don't think of myself as a TV guy who also, you know, on the side has a radio show. I think of myself as a radio guy who on the side has this a television show. And I enjoy doing both, and I think that there's a certain in some ways they help one another. At first, I didn't like the idea that on television, I thought it was something the matter with my television delivery or something. They perceived it that way, but then I realized it was not that I was doing it differently. It was because they had a different picture in their heads of what I ought to look like, I was not that guy that they thought I was.
What do you think the best storytellers have in common?
Well, I think a sense of storytelling, I think, starts when you're a kid and people read you stories. That's why I got such a kick recently out of, you know, I was the narrator of this movie, Horton Hears a Who.
Yeah.
And it was quite a surprise to me, but I was familiar with that one and all the other Dr. Seuss stories. In fact, my first book, which was called Nothing Could Be Finer Than a Crisis That Is Minor in the Morning, the dedication was to Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, who gave me a new way to look at the noose, N-E-U-S-S. And by the way, I got a note from him on Cat in the Hat, the stationery, saying nothing could be finer than to be an Osgood Inspireiner. But anyway, the phone rang, and in my office, I was at lunch, and my assistant, Liz Powers, said, you just got a call from 20th Century Fox. They want you to be in a movie. So we did it, and it's a big kick.
You seem so incredibly comfortable with what you're doing, and I'm wondering if you felt that way throughout every phase of your career, or if you feel like everything is building toward where you are and what you're doing now.
Television took some getting used to for me. And I know that I was not only not very good, I was just awful at first.
Really? Because why?
It frightened me to be seen. And I was so used to, you know, the old radio guys would do this sort of thing, you know, talking into the microphone. And they'd have funny little gestures that you'd do to make the sound more animated. But if you do those on television, you look as if you've lost your mind. So it's not that I was doing those things. It was just that I didn't know what to do. And I guess partly because I was at CBS and I worked with such terrific people there, including my predecessor, Charles Corralt, and you can see that there was this. You have to be aware of everything that's going on. But basically, the most important thing to do is to make sure that your mind is engaged. You know, it's not just a bunch of words that you have to get in within a certain amount of time. It's you're saying something. And the writing is to organize that in such a way that it will be most effective, and the delivery has to be that you're talking to somebody. You know, a talking head is now bad news on television. You're not supposed to have talking heads, but you and I are talking heads, and I think we're great.
Do you think Americans have lost the ability to listen carefully?
I think not paying attention is a big problem for. And I think that's the reason that it's come down to this business of short bites, because it is the belief of the powers that be in the media, except of course for public radio and public television, that the attention span of the audience is very, very short, and that if you go on and on and on, 15 seconds or so, they'll go away. And that's the other thing about television that I'm aware of, is that people, this tremendous preoccupation with movement, something happening on the screen.
Bright colors and sound effects.
And it's as if they think the audience is a baby in a crib. And you have to put that, the little mobile that they put attached to a crib, it has to make a noise, and it has to move, and it has to be colorful. So I guess on color television, I'm standing there trying to talk to the audience. In the meantime, in the control room, they're doing everything that they can think of to distract the viewer from seeing what's there. It's much less so on Sunday morning, I must say. Although we have our share of that. You've got to be standing next to something or you're holding something. It's got to be. It's a kind of show and tell all the time. And yet, I think that there's nothing more fascinating than listening to somebody who has something to say, and giving them a chance to say it, complete with all of the things we do when we talk. All the things we do with that head.
Charles, I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you so much for stopping by.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
The new book is called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the White House. Just ahead on Think, Recapturing Cuba. We'll get a preview of the new documentary about Havana-born Dallas artist Rolando Diaz and talk to filmmaker Harry Lynch. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Deep in the Arts calendar for Memorial Day weekend features Fair Park festivities, modern primitives, and southern melodrama. Grapevine's Runway Theater invites you inside the stormy, boozy world of Maggie the Cat and Brick in their new run of Tennessee Williams' Pulitzer Prize-winning Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. The Jubilee Theater in Fort Worth offers up Blue, Charles Randolph Wright's tender portrayal of the ties binding an affluent South Carolina family, with original music from Nona Hendrix. On stage at the Addison Theater Center, Water Tower Theater goes back to the turn of the century for Intimate Apparel, Lynn Nottage's story of a corset maker's quest for love and freedom. For the gallery goers, Dallas's HCG Gallery opens Postmodern Primitives, a group show with contemporary works inspired by the cultures of yore. And for your long weekend, ArtFest 2008 celebrates its 39th year at its original Fair Park location, and a weekend packed with art, music, culinary delights, and entertainment for all ages. For these and other events, or to join the Arts and Culture blog, go to KERA.org. For Deep in the Arts, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
In what ways are artists defined by the places they come from? In 2003, Dallas painter Rolando Diaz returned to Cuba for the first time since his family fled when he was 8 years old.
Ed, this is it. It's one street over, isn't it? Is it one street over?
When I was 8 years old, my family fled Cuba in a boat. We left behind everything but the clothes on our backs. The last time I saw these streets, there were soldiers marching in them.
Esta es. A ver. Esta es. Look at this. This is it right here. This is it, dude. This is it, man. I cannot believe we're here.
My father died 7 months after we arrived in America. Mother died several years later. Life was hard for my brother and me, but we never let go of our dreams. 10 years ago, I quit my job as a graphic designer to become an artist full-time. I think the success I've had in my art career finally gave me the courage to return to the Cuba of my youth.
It's really beat up, man, but I tell you, it's the same old place. I remember those steps so well.
For 38 years, this house lived in my memory, frozen in time. For 38 years, the only new images of my homeland came from TV or magazines. But I came here not only to reconnect with my past, I came to shape my future.
That's a clip from the new documentary about Rolando Diaz and his work. It's called Recapturing Cuba, and it debuts May 28th on KERA television. And we are delighted to have filmmaker Harry Lynch here to talk about it. Harry, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
What notions did you have as an American about Cuba before you started the project?
I had no idea what to expect. I really didn't. It's hard to get much information about Cuba, up here. And that was one of the reasons that we were so excited about going down there. It's one of the things we thought would be really great about the film, was just another chance for Americans to see what Cuba is actually like.
I was astounded to learn that there are 18,000 working artists in Havana alone.
I think it's 22,000. But yeah, one of the things you can do in Havana to make a living, and probably one of the best livings you can have, is as an artist, because you can sell your art on the international market, and so you get command nearly international prices. So a good artist there might sell a work for $20,000. Now a good portion of that goes back to the government, but that's an enormous amount of money for down there. Where a surgeon makes $500 a year, you could have an artist making $500 a day or a week or something like that. So it encourages lots of art, great art.
How much of that art stays in Cuba, though? Does all of it go away?
You know, one of the things you'll see in the film is that a lot of these artists have a lot of art stockpiled in their studios, which you don't see here because there's not quite enough of a market down there to consume it all. But some of it stays there. The museums there are pretty fabulous. But a lot of it goes to Mexico and other countries that don't have embargoes against Cuba like the U.S. does. So there's a big European market for it. There's a big Latin American market for it.
It was really interesting to see how much of Cuban art takes European traditions, for example, and really sort of adds a Cuban sensibility. Or they'll take the African traditions but really interpret them through their own lens. Can you talk about what Cuban artists bring to their work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those are two of the influences, Africa, Europe, and the Revolution. And we kind of discovered that as we were down there. We didn't really know all that much about Cuban art before we went down. Rolando probably knew more, but Africa, Europe, and the Revolution are kind of the three things that influenced it, but also the tropical light and color palette. And if you look at Rolando's work, he hadn't been back to the island in 37 years or something like that, but his color palette and his sense of light were the same. It's something that must be ingrained in you when you're very young. And so that's laid on top of those other three influences.
It's interesting because one of the questions he's asking himself as he goes down there is whether he would have been an artist had he stayed in Cuba, or whether mm-hmm. he would have done something else. Mm-hmm. And we'll leave the resolution to that for people to see in the film. But I'm wondering if the film caused you to think about yourself as an American and the way that you've been influenced by the place you grew up.
That's an interesting question. Maybe not so much the way I've been influenced it, but every time I go to a country that has a kind of different political and economic system than we do, it's always culture shock to come back. And Cuba was probably the most that way because there's no advertising. The only billboards are political billboards, and they all are about Che or Castro or something like that. And it's a very different society. But no, I didn't think about that. I'll have to think about that since you've asked me.
I know that you did have State Department permission to go, but you were embargoed from bringing anything back. So did you have to leave all the art there?
No, at that time, and I don't know if it's still this way, by the Freedom of the Press Act, Bill of Rights, you can bring back press, mm-hmm. Printed material, which includes painting. So had I known that, or had I had more forethought, I would have taken down a lot of cash and brought back a lot of art. Instead, I didn't. I brought a couple pieces back. But if I had an opportunity to go back again, there's so much amazing art down there, I would go back and get a lot of stuff.
Do you imagine that the embargo will change in maybe the coming administration?
I do think so. You know, I really do think. Well, I don't know if it'll change. I don't know if the embargo will go away. I know that I imagine that the regulations will become more lax. Mm-hmm. I really think so. I hope so.
Harry, thank you so much for coming in.
Sure, thank you. My pleasure.
The new film is called Recapturing Cuba. It debuts on KERA 13 on May 28th. It will also screen at Victory Park on June 12th. To download free video and audio podcasts of this show, you can go to kera.org/think. Our email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us and have a great week. So what did you...
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead, on the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive, and by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.